This is Earth Files, the award-winning news site with the latest updates in science, environment, and real X-Files. Podcasting in-depth reports beyond the 6 o'clock news by Emmy Award-winning journalist Linda Moulton Howe.
The last week of April 2007, media headlined that University of California, San Francisco biochemists had, quote, tracked down suspect in honeybee disappearances, unquote. The culprit? The news media called it a fungus, but it's not a fungus. It's a one-celled protozoan called Nosema serinae. The problem with that proposed answer? Nosema serinae had been identified long before in Spain, other European countries, and the United States in both healthy, normal honeybees, as well as bee bodies found around empty hives where colony collapse disorder has been reported. In CCD, the bees have disappeared in the billions in both the northern and southern hemispheres since the fall of 2006. 5 months ago, in December, scientists in the Colony Collapse Disorder Working Group reported to the public that whatever was causing the massive honeybee disappearances was also severely suppressing honeybee immune systems, leaving the bees vulnerable to all sorts of pathogens, including the Nosema protozoan. The fragility of the honeybee immune system was confirmed by the Genome Project last October, which for the first time mapped all the genes in honeybees. DNA researchers found that there were not many genes to deal with poisons or to fight off disease. The conclusion was that honeybees might be especially vulnerable to attacks by pathogens and pesticides and other toxins. The University of Montana's Bee Alert Group recently surveyed more than 500 American beekeepers to find out how many have had bees disappear. The statistic now is 38% of beekeepers have reported hive disappearances, some losing 75% or more of all their bees. One bee colony in California went from thriving to complete disappearance in only 2 days. That's why the late April 2007 UC San Francisco announcement that Nosema serinae was most likely the cause of CCD was surprising and confusing. This week, I asked Jerry Hayes, chief of the apiary section at Florida's Department of Agriculture in Gainesville, Florida, about the Nosema news release.
That was kind of an awkward situation because the CCD working group had already identified Nosema serrana, which is a one-celled protozoan that lives in a honeybee's intestine. The lab in California didn't contact us, but it was good that they did the work because it confirmed what we had already known. But it doesn't seem to be a major player at this time because all the samples that we have taken from all bees seem to have serrana in them. So it's not something that appears to be a brand new pathogen.
Well, then why did this hit the headlines with that professor seeming to say this is the answer?
Got me, Linda.
Well, I wanted to understand because I thought I had talked with you and Professor Cox Foster and all of these people in the 2 weeks leading up to when you and I had talked,
right,
and nobody was focusing on Nosema, but I knew that it had come up back in February because they had found it in Spain.
Yeah, and so then there was separate diagnosis of that from the USDA lab in Beltsville, probably a month ago, and so this was not something new to us, and then have this kind of blurted out, we thought was kind of interesting.
Is there any reason why the San Francisco researchers who put out the information about Nosema possibly being the explanation for the colony collapse disorder, not having checked with the colony collapse disorder scientists before releasing the information?
It certainly seems to be a disconnect in the communication process, and we hope that in the future our other colleagues in other realms and expertises will be able to work more closely with us. These guys kind of charged ahead and identified something we already knew about, and This has been widely identified in Europe and Spain and France for several years. And so there are treatments, there are controls for it. So it's something that beekeepers are addressing already.
Why did the Colony Collapse Disorder Science Group dismiss Nosema as not being the cause for the general disappearances of honeybees?
Because beekeepers were already, in many cases, treating with the antibiotic for Nosema in the samples that we took. So some of the samples the beekeepers had been treating and did not have Nosema, and some of them they didn't. So it didn't seem to be a connection. CCD appeared whether they were treating or not.
So the idea that the San Francisco researchers released in their announcement that this Nosema unicellular protozoa was found in all of the bodies of the bees that they studied, that is misleading.
I think they jumped the gun, yeah.
And it may have been a fluke that the bees that they specifically received for study had it, but it did not represent the universal collection that you all have been studying since the fall.
Well, it's kind of interesting that all the samples that we've taken and all the samples of even healthy colonies all show Nosema serrani. We can't find the other Nosema, Nosema apis. So all bees have Nosema serrani, but yet only some are exhibiting the CCD. And because there's a treatment for it, it seems to be certainly is a stressor, but it doesn't seem to be the smoking gun that we were looking for.
And the fact that both healthy and colony collapse disorder bees would have Nosema fits again into Professor Diana Cox Foster's hypothesis that this was a symptom of immune collapse.
Yeah, it seems to be a more strong hypothesis as the days go by that something is affecting the bees' immune system, and many of these things we're finding, which are normal pathogens, are proliferating because the bees' immune system cannot handle it.
It sounds as if then that the California researchers had not studied the body of the Colony Collapse Disorder Science Group's work from December on, and that they made a leap based on a finding as opposed to placing the finding in the context of, let's say, the idea of suppressed immune systems making the bees generally vulnerable to more pathogens?
Yeah, you know, they made a leap. We just need to collaborate more so that we can move ahead and see what we can find.
And as you and I speak on May 2nd, 2007, is it correct that to date there still is not an answer to colony collapse disorder?
No, there's not. And in fact, I'm going down and take a whole other series of bee samples from some commercial beekeepers. And of course, we're getting reports from other parts of the country that they're just now finding it as spring comes, and this is ongoing.
In the first week of May 2007, the national program leader for the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Bee and Pollination Program told Associated Press that if the honeybee collapse continues to worsen, Americans could end up, quote, stuck with grains and water. This is the biggest general threat to our food supply, unquote. Another threat in the American landscape that some microbiologists are calling potentially catastrophic to freshwater fish is a deadly Ebola-like virus known as viral hemorrhagic septicemia, or VHS. Until 1988, VHS was believed to infect only European freshwater fish, especially rainbow trout exported from the U.S. at the end of the 19th century. But eventually, the virus was confirmed in Asian waters in the Pacific. Then, only 2 years ago, in 2005, to the shock of aquatic specialists, millions of fish died in Lake Ontario in the Great Lakes, bleeding from viral hemorrhagic septicemia. And many more died in the Great Lakes in 2006, also bleeding. One scientist who has been studying the lethal virus is Jim Winton, Ph.D., microbiologist and chief of fish health for the U.S. Geological Survey's Western Fisheries Research Center in Seattle. I ask him about the size of VHS die-offs in the Great Lakes and what the disease symptoms are.
We're talking about thousands of metric tons of some of the species. Some of these die-offs have resulted in dead fish piling up on the beaches in you know, literally 1 or 2 feet deep. We never see all of the fish that die in an outbreak, even in freshwater. But in the marine environment, we hardly see them at all. But if you see 1,000 fish on the beach, there's probably more than 10 times or maybe 50 times that many out in the water someplace. The symptoms of the virus, it attacks fairly quickly, are principally, as the name implies, hemorrhages of the skin and a necrosis or destruction of the internal tissues, mainly the blood-forming tissues of the kidney and spleen, and to some extent the liver as well. And so the virus actually destroys the organ function and tissue function of the fish. They die sometimes of osmotic shock from the destruction of the skin, but more often due to failure of the kidney or other organ systems.
Would the first symptom that we would see on these fish be outright bleeding from the head or the body?
Yes, you would see reddish areas of hemorrhage and lesions on the body of the fish. It's important to say that this virus has no effect on humans. It only affects cold water and cool water fish.
Professor Paul Bowser at Cornell University was quoted as saying, "What's so disturbing is that it's killing fish from so many species and with amazingly high mortality levels."
Yes.
Could you comment on that?
Well, he's exactly right. We are surprised that this virus has such a broad host range. Yeah, we have over 20 species of fish that have produced virus isolates that have been sent to our laboratory for confirmation or identification. Some of them have died in very large numbers, and that's somewhat surprising. In Europe, the virus caused high mortality, but only in a few species. Paul Bowser and others have actually seen the degree of the mortality that occurs, and they've been very impressed by it.
And the fact that the Great Lakes die-offs are affecting at least 20 species, does that reinforce again the question, is there something, a toxin, something else in the Great Lakes water that is suppressing the immune systems of all of these species and making them more vulnerable to this virus?
We don't think so, and that may yet be proven correct. But we have no evidence that this is other than the introduction of a highly virulent mutation of the virus into a population that has never seen it before. And that was true of smallpox with Native Americans. There was no toxin or other things, but people died at very high levels. And influenza in Inuits killed like 100% of the population in some villages. Naive populations have no innate resistance to some introduced pathogens, and it doesn't take a toxin or anything else to make them more susceptible.
Right now, we're in beginning May of 2007. What is your greatest fear as the waters start warming up with this summer?
Well, I think we've already seen the beginning of a couple of potential outbreaks. We're awaiting confirmation, but my greatest fear would be that the virus will spread outside of the Great Lakes Basin. My second greatest fear is that it will spread to the remainder of the Great Lakes. It's not currently known to be in Lake Michigan or Lake Superior. And my third greatest fear is that it will continue to cause high levels of mortality for a fairly long period of time. If the virus leaves the Great Lakes Basin, spreads into aquaculture, it could have very high economic impacts. If it spreads into other parts of the country, it could have very high ecological impacts because the species that are shown to be susceptible in the Great Lakes are widely distributed, and they include things like largemouth and smallmouth bass, which may be present in almost every state in the country.
What is the worst case by the fall of 2007?
Well, the worst case would be that the virus is found to have left the Great Lakes and is spreading down the Mississippi or into other parts of the country, where in these wild populations, it's largely uncontrollable. We have very few tools that we can use to actually manage disease in wild populations. We have good diagnostic tools and we have vaccines that can help if the virus were to spread to aquaculture. But even so, it's going to be an increasingly difficult management and economic problem.
This was from USA Today recently by Dennis Kashan.
Yep.
And he was quoting you, and this was the quote. The VHS virus is the most important and dangerous fish virus known worldwide. Its discovery in our fresh water is disturbing and potentially catastrophic, unquote.
Mm-hmm.
Those are your words, and that's where I've been left with the impression that this could be catastrophic in terms of massive die-offs across these 20 species of fish or more.
Well, I think catastrophic certainly within the context of the Great Lakes ecosystem and the fisheries resources. The word catastrophic refers within certain fisheries resources, and as a fish health problem, it is in fact catastrophic.
And if the impact of the virus in 2007 is in the catastrophic range in the context of the fish populations in the U.S., does that mean that whole species could be nearly wiped out in 2007?
No species is commonly wiped out by an introduced pathogen. The populations will be reduced and eventually will develop some resistance. They may never recover to their former numbers, but they will not be wiped out.
As May unfolds into June with higher temperatures rising in the Great Lakes, is it fair to say that the number of fish die-offs will probably start increasing in a very, very significant way?
I think it will start increasing. We don't know how significant because we don't know what percent of the population has already seen this virus over the last 2 years. If a significant fraction of the existing fish in the Great Lakes have experienced this virus and have some increased resistance to it, the die-offs will not be as large as they were last year. But my feeling is that there are still a very large number of susceptible fish in some parts of the Great Lakes, and I think we'll see the virus causing mortality in some of those populations, and it may be in new parts of the lakes, and it may be in new lakes, and it might be even in new species.
If it gets outside of the Great Lakes, would it be in the states around Michigan, or?
It's hard to know. I mean, the Great Lakes Basin drains a fair number of states in the north-central portion, but there are connections and pathways outside of the Great Lakes into the Mississippi drainage.
And so if it gets into the Mississippi River, then it spreads throughout that whole Mississippi River drainage all the way down to New Orleans, correct?
Potentially.
And then what exponentially is the problem that you all face in trying to deal with it?
Well, obviously, it's easier to contain a virus to a given watershed, even as large as the Great Lakes, than it would be to try to contain it if it starts spreading to significant portions of the United States. So we're actually quite worried about this virus spreading outside of the Great Lakes, whether it's into the Mississippi or across the Rocky Mountains. And should that happen, then the problem will be magnified considerably.
And are we talking then about millions and millions of fish die-offs throughout the Mississippi drainage?
Well, it's hard to put any kind of numbers to that. I mean, this is something we have very little past experience. This is almost certainly the largest example of a natural outbreak in multiple species of aquatic animals like fish that any of us have ever experienced. So we don't have a lot to go on. I think we have a long ways to go before we know how this is going to play out.
What can be done to contain or eliminate VHS from American freshwater fish? The U.S. Department of Agriculture, the Canadian government, and states in the Great Lakes region are now enacting emergency regulations to stop people in the summer of 2007 from transporting potentially infected fish from areas in the Great Lakes where there have been massive die-offs and to keep those fish out of areas that they think are still clean from the virus. As Dr. Winton said, if the lethal hemorrhagic virus spreads outside the Great Lakes into river systems such as the Mississippi, it will be catastrophic for freshwater fish and their related ecosystems in the United States. So there are at least two environmental emergencies now in America that could directly impact our food supplies, honeybees that are massively disappearing and not pollinating crops, and the Ebola-like virus that could decimate at least 20 species or more. a fresh water fish.
Thanks for listening to this Earth Files podcast from the edges of science, environment, and real X-Files. Go to www.earthfiles.com to see more than 1,000 Earth Files reports with photographs, drawings, and documents. And visit Earth Files every day, every week, for new reports and new podcasts. That's www.earthfiles.com.